Labor machtala the kasva. They raised his eye. He said, "Lift up my eyelids so I can look at this man." And they lifted up his eyelids with some silver tweezers. Chaza de parte sachafte. He saw that Rav Kana had a grimace. That is, Rav Kana had some kind of an illness or a defect which caused his mouth always to be shaped in the form of a grimace. Savar achuch kamachai hibe. Rav Yochanan thought that Rav Kana was laughing at him because of this distortion in his mouth. Chalash da'ate. Rabbi Yochanan was extremely upset, v'nach nafshe, and that had the effect of killing Rav Kana. L'machar amalu Rabbi Yochanan l'rabbanan. Rabbi Yochanan said to the assembled, Haziti l'bava hechi avid. Did you see how disrespectful this Babylonian was? Amu le'dar kehachi. That was just his normal appearance. So Rabbi Yochanan went to Rav Kana's grave. Chazi dahavi hadwale uchna. He saw that there was a snake which was preventing, there was a large snake preventing Rabbi Yochanan from reaching Rav Kana's grave. Amale achna achna ptach pumech v'ikame sarav etzel hatalmid. Snake, snake, open your mouth and let the teacher come to the student. V'lo patach. So then Rabbi Yochanan says, Yikanes chaver eitzel chaver v'lo patach. Let one colleague visit another colleague, and the snake didn't open his mouth. Then he said, Yikanes talmid eitzel harav. Let the student approach the master, patachle. Then the snake allowed Rabbi Yochanan to enter Rav Kahana's grave. Vay rachme, Rabbi Yochanan then requested mercy from God, v'ukme, and he raised Rav Kahana from the dead. Amale, ihavi yadana de dake de marachi lo chal shadate. Had I known that this was just your normal appearance, I would not have become upset. Hashta leiti mar bahadam. Why don't you come back to us to our session? Amale, im matzi livoy rachmi ditu lo shachivna azilna. If you can make a request that I will not be sent back to the dead again because of some seemingly disrespectful action, then I will come. V'ilo lo azilna. Otherwise, I prefer to stay here in the grave. Ho'il v'chala shayte chalif tarei u'kmei shayle kol speker d'havale u'pashtinin ulehe. Hainu d'amor av Yochanan dilchon amri dilhina. That though the Torah, which we think is Israel Torah, Torah of Eretz Israel, really belongs to the scholars of Babel. At any event, whether all the details of the story are historically true or not, we can question, but we get a description of two things which are important to us. One is the fact that Rav Kana, typically, in many, many cases, Rav Kana was seated before a rav in a court case. And secondly, we get a description of what a classroom was looking like at the time of Rav Yochanan. Since this was obviously written with a Babylonian bias, that is, someone, a scholar from Eretz Yisrael, wouldn't necessarily put in the mouth of Rabbi Yochanan that the Babylonian scholars were superior to the Israelite scholars. What we really have is a description, of course, of what a school room, a lecture hall, looked like around this time in Babel, or maybe shortly after the time of Rabbi Yochanan, in Babel at the time of Eretz Yisrael. Okay, let's go on. Where did these cases get tried? In other words, physically, where were the court sessions? The indication seems to be that they were all, in fact, as we've just seen, to some extent attached to the school, where the word school means, of course, the academy of the great scholar. It doesn't necessarily mean a self-perpetuating institution. For example, what we have in the Gemara Sanhedrin. Amar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, Asara sheyoshvin bedin, 10 who were sitting in judgment, Kolau talu b'tzalhu kolau. The chain hangs on the necks of all of them. Pshita. Of course, if there's a session with 10 judges, obviously, each one of the 10 judges accepts responsibility. What's the innovation here? So the Gemara says, Lo tzricha ela l'talmid ha-yoshev l'fnei rabo. For it refers to the case of a student who is sitting in front of his teacher. Rav Huna, ki havi ota dina lakamei, whenever a court case would come to Rav Huna, michnif umaisi asarara banan mi beirav, he would assemble 10 students from the house of Liberav, from the house of the teacher, or maybe from the house of the teacher. Ama ki heki delimten shiba mikshua, that each one of them can carry away a chip. In other words, the custom was that when a court session would be in place, a lot of students would be present there, and Rav Huna said that this would also let the students bear, I bear the whole beam, but at least the students will carry away some of the chips of responsibility. Right? So from this we see, first of all, that there was an institution called Beirav, meaning the house of the master, or maybe meaning the house of Rav, but let's take it more generally, meaning the house of the master. And students would be assembled. So what one might think of as A, the yeshivot at this time was sort of like apprenticeships, law apprenticeships, judicial apprenticeships. The head judge would assemble around him a whole lot of students. There would be lectures to the students from time to time. It would be just like in medicine, where probably until the founding of official medical schools in this country, the rounds were the only means in which a doctor would just get his education. And even to this day, it's the students who go with the physicians in their rounds who learn their trade by watching the master perform and then participating to some extent in the discussion. So similarly, we can sort of take for granted that at all times in Bavel, as opposed to Eretz Yisrael, the courts were manned by scholars as opposed to being democratically chosen from the bottom up, the way they were frequently in Eretz Yisrael. And secondly, the educational institutions were all surrounding one of the leading scholars, one of the leading rabbanim, who would then have students taken along with him whenever there were cases, and the cases themselves would be physically tried, probably right at the master's schoolhouse, that is, in front of the yeshiva. Here's another case. And we read this last time. Okay.
What happened once the master died?
Ah.
Who took over? Did anyone take over?
So that's our problem. Our problem is, how did a new master get selected? And on this, for example, No, you see, it doesn't presume that it's an institution, and that's our problem. I think that we're faced precisely with the problem. The problem is, for example, was there an institution called a yeshiva, or was this an apprenticeship which then developed into an institution? If there was such an institution, who appointed the head of this institution and how was it replaced? To answer your question, here are some quotations. Here's a Gemara in Brachot, which probably you know. Omar Rav Abin Halevi, this is from Brachot, Daf Samach Dalet. Kol hadochek et hasha'a, hasha'a dochakato. V'kol hanidchem mipnei hasha'a, sha'a nidchet et mipana. Someone who presses his advantage at a particular time will lose. On the other hand, someone who tries to avoid the good fortune will seek him out. Midrabba bar Rav Yosef, from the story of Rabba and Rav Yosef. The Rav Yosef Sinai, the Rabba Oker Harim. Rav Yosef was a master of knowledge. Rav Yosef, the phrase Sinai here technically means someone who has a phenomenal memory. That is, he knows a huge amount of material. And Rabba, on the other hand, was very ingenious, very clever, very bright. And the issue was, apparently, because next Gemara says, Itztuchuhu lehushata. The time came when they were needed. Rashi interprets Iskuhu Lushaita to mean that they were appointed. Iskahul, Shaita Rashi interprets, Liyot Echad Mehem Rosh Yeshiva. Iskahulahu Gar Sinan, Utsuhulahem Chachamim. Of course, Rashi is again assuming, if we interpret the word yeshiva to mean an institution, assuming that there was an institution called a yeshiva. But perhaps again, what's being decided here is that who's going to be the major authority in town. Remember, again, even into our times, the people who somehow or other became great halachic authorities were not necessarily people who were attached to major institutions or any institution at all. For example, Moshe Feinstein was certainly the leading posek in this country for the last 30 years of his life. It's true that he was a Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Sheferes Yerushalayim, but this was certainly not one of the major institutions on the Jewish scene. Certainly the leading halakhic authority, the person who had the most impact on the change of the way in which halakha was produced in Eretz Yisrael in the last 50 years was the Chazon Ish, who had no academic standing whatsoever. He was never attached to a yeshiva, he never studied in a yeshiva, he was... No. In other words, he by dint of the personal authority that he, the charisma, one can use a word of the Weber or the sociologist, the charisma that he was able to exude by virtue of his scholarship and personality was enough to allow him to have major authority above and beyond all of the officially appointed rabbanim and all of the heads of various different yeshivot and educational institutions. So, the Chafetz Chaim no doubt had a major impact. In the last 50 or 60 years, the person who certainly had the most impact in the change of direction of Orthodox or Haredi behavior was the Chazon Ish.
Even after the Chazon Ish, even today, it's the same thing. None of them were essentially those who had impact. Were Rosh Yeshiva.
Right. Well, some were. Rav Shlomo Zalman was a Rosh Yeshiva in a certain sense, but his role as Rosh Yeshiva was minor. Yeah. So it's not clear what this phrase Istofu Lushaita means, as Rashi interprets it to be the head of the yeshiva, but it may also mean who should be the established head of our community. What's interesting here is that this question was, there wasn't an appointment of either of these individuals by the Reish Galuta, for example. So answering your question, but there was a question raised. So let's read this. It says, so they sent all the way to Israel. Sinai v'oker harim ezo mehim kodem. Who is preferable, the man with a vast amount of stored knowledge or the man who's smarter, more gifted at reasoning? Sinai kodem she'akol tzarich l'mari chatya. The person with the knowledge is better because everyone needs the actual knowledge. To be able to figure something out, you have to know something to start with. Aval pichen, nevertheless, lo kibel alav Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef refused to accept the position. Da amrile kaldai malchit tartin shnim, because the astrologers had told him that he would rule for exactly 2 years. Malach rabba eschin v'tartin shnim. So therefore, Rabba ruled for 22 years. Malach Rav Yosef tautin shnin upalda. Rav Yosef ruled after that for 2.5 years. Kol hanach shni de malach Rabba, all of the time that Rabba ruled, afilu umna levete lo kol. Rav Yosef wouldn't even call a blood letter to come to his house. If he had some medical problem, rather than to show that he was an important person and have a doctor come to him, he would go to the doctor's office. Nowadays, I guess house visits don't exist at all, but... Okay. So to answer your question, we don't really know all the details of what was going on here, but the Gemara uses the phrase malach. Later, 600 or 700 years later, and we'll get to this next week, I hope, in the letter of Rav Shrier Gaon, we found that he uses the word malach to mean was the head of the yeshiva. At his time, there existed a well-established, well-organized official institution called the yeshiva, and someone was appointed the dean. And that's what it meant. Okay?
In particular, for example, in Rabbi Yochanan's case, where Rabbi Yochanan might be best name, did anyone take over from him?
Yeah. But, I mean, Rabbi Yochanan was the head of his school and of a local court. He was not, he was a part of the Sanhedrin, but he was not a the patriarch at any time.
Someone took over for him. So
that we don't know. That's exactly what we don't know.
We don't know what is the
right. On this issue of Rabba of Rav Yosef, I wanted to also quote a Gemara. In Ketubot, which is related to this, the Gemara in Ketubot raises a technical question having to do with the Mishnah says that in the case of a rape, the penalty is paid to the father. But if the father dies, the penalty, the various fines and so on, the damages are collected by the daughter herself. And the difference would be, for instance, that if the father collects the damages and then he dies, the brothers inherit and the daughter doesn't see any of this money. On the other hand, if it's her money, then it goes directly to her. And the Gemara raises the issue as to what happens if the case went to court and maybe even was decided, but the father hadn't yet collected and died. Who is... Who claims the money? Does the daughter claim the money because the father had not yet collected and therefore it's not part of the estate and therefore the brothers don't inherit and therefore it devolves to her? Okay, and or is this actually, since the case has already been tried and settled, even though the money hasn't been collected, it's like any other debt that may be become part of the estate and therefore is collectible by the estate and therefore goes to the brothers. The Gemara says, Amar Rava, Hai Milta Kashaiva Rava Rav Yosef Eschin Vetartan Shni. This problem was in dispute between Rav. Was a difficulty between at the time of Rabba and Rabbi Yosef for 22 years. The lo ifrik, and it was not resolved ad the ativ Rabbi Yosef bereisha upir, until Rabbi Yosef took over. So obviously this was a type of some theoretical or maybe a practical court case, and we can see from here that the issue of malach means who was actually able to rule, make it come to precedent and a court decision on all these various different cases. So obviously Rabba and Rav Yosef, when the Gemara uses the word malach, it doesn't merely mean that they became the dean of some institution or other, or even that there was such an institution. But it means that they were the legal authority in deciding various court cases, and here was a particular case that Rabba, even though he was the cleverer of the two, but not the master of the material, was unable to resolve during his lifetime, and it was only resolved after when Rav Yosef took over.
Is there an implication that there was a conflict between them?
It may be that there was a conflict between them, or it may simply mean that this issue was never resolved by the court until Rav Yosef actually took over as the head of the court. Yes? Yes, there is. There are lots of those. But again, the question is this simply lineage? My PhD advisor is at a completely different institution from me, right? So therefore, the fact that there's a lineage between master and student doesn't relate to the issue of the headship, deanship, or whatever you want to call it, of a particular institution. And this is something that we just simply don't know. We're left in the dark, but I think that we can... I want to spend a little bit of time reading from Neusner's book, because but So the conclusion that we draw from all of these stories is that there was an evolving institution which eventually became the yeshiva that we know and recognize in the 8th or 9th century. And this yeshiva is well described because we have three independent Gaonic sources which describe this institution. One is from a visitor called Natan HaBavli, who actually gives a description of the yeshiva to people who've never seen a yeshiva, so therefore it's a pretty good description. And then we have two historical documents. There's the Seder Tanoim Ve'amoraim, and the principal document on which all of our historical analysis is based is the famous letter of Rav Shridhar Gaon, which, as I said last week, comes in two rather distinct versions. And we have to, first of all, decide which between these two versions is preferable. I won't trouble you with that tonight, but we will go into some detail next week in Yotzer Shem in an analysis of the letter of Rav Shridhar Gaon. The institution evolved, but the courts were always attached to the rabbis in Bavel, and physically the courts were attached to those institutions in which the rabbis taught. Whether these institutions had an independent existence, like the yeshiva in later years, or like the university in later years. I mean, one finds the same thing in law schools, for example, that the original types of Roman law were taught in various apprenticeships. It was only later that law schools as universities were established as independent institutions. So this thing was happening both in the Jewish community and elsewhere. One might call it the advent of professionalism in education as well. And there was also the authority of the exilarch to give an additional amount of appointment authority to judges who would have special prerogatives above and beyond the judges who were only self-appointed by their own charisma, if you like. But as you pointed out last week, people might have very well preferred those judges who were self-appointed for one reason or another. People went to Rav Sheshet's court even though Rav Nachman was the one who was self-appointed. Okay, let me read a bit from one of the 1001 books by Neusner, who is...
Literally.
Yeah. I mean, I have very mixed feelings because he has this, I don't know what the correct word is, bibliorrhea or something like that. I mean, he just publishes huge amounts of books. If they were all junk, one could just simply dispense with them, but they're not all junk. He has lots and lots of good ideas, and then is very sloppy in carrying them through. For example, in one of his major books, he tries to just simply disentangle from all the cases that are found all the way in the Gemara during all periods, those cases which were actual, real law cases, as opposed to those problems which were raised as theoretical discussions. Now, of course, some of these distinctions are very easy to make. If you see two Amoraim discussing a problem in Hilchot Karbanot, we know that they weren't talking about an actual problem, but were discussing a theoretical issue having to do with sacrificial law, which was not existent at their time. But when it comes to cases which are current, well, one still has to try to see whether there was a real case here or whether this was a theoretical discussion. And you know, to tabulate all of these cases and summarize them and see which were actual court cases and which are not is obviously a very useful function and a very good idea, something to do. And he does it, but he does it just very poorly. So it's typical that, for example, a careful analysis of what was going on in trying to reach this is in the last of the handout of today. I'll let you to read it, but you will see that Gaffney, in an article, Yeshayahu Gaffney, just goes through this, and the article is called Ma'aseh Beit Din B'Talmud HaBavli, and then he just gives a list of various things which are clearly court cases. From the collection of this list of court cases, and essentially no court cases which weren't, which were recorded, which weren't attributed to the Rabbanim, one gets to the conclusion of what I said, namely that the courts in Babel were in fact manned by scholars. On the other hand, he, Gaffney, wrote a whole book called Yehudei Babel B'Tkufat HaTalmud, which I borrowed from my son, and it's a bad book. I mean, it's not a particularly good book. There's another book which I think is better and earlier, which is called Rashut HaGola, B'Babel B'Mei HaMishnah V'HaTalmud, which is not a bad book, but there are many things in more modern scholarship. This was a book written in the late 60s. No, this is by someone by the called Moshe Baer. I don't know him personally. I don't know either of these people personally. But let me simply read to you for the last 15, how much time do we have? 15 minutes. Let me read to you from one of Neusner's 1,000 or so books so you can get a flavor.
Yeah, Brown University?
He was at Brown. I think he's retired from Brown. Now in Florida. He's very big in the conservative movement, I think. I think so. All right. Throughout
politically also.
Right. Throughout Babylonia, present-day Iraq, in Talmudic times, the first seven centuries of the Christian era, Jews lived in a cosmopolitan, many-splendored world in which diverse groups governed their own affairs and worshipped a variety of gods. The Iranians formed a large empire made up of diverse groups, most of them speaking varieties of Iranian languages, but minorities preserving their own languages. For example, Greek, Arabic, Aramaic in various versions, Armenian, and the like. The western provinces of the empire were polyglot and cosmopolitan. The Iranians governed lightly by allowing the various groups to run their own affairs in a system which we have later come to call the millet system, after the Turkish word for the same approach for the government of multicultural empires. And remember from 2 weeks ago I pointed out that the encyclopedia took this granted to be the normal rule in the Turkish Empire and in the Russian Empire. We were quoting from the Encyclopedia Britannica 1911 edition again. Okay. And this difference, of course, is going to plague us throughout. That is, when there were strong centralized national states or empires which wanted to impose their own law, like the British Empire or the Roman Empire, on one hand, and the existence of the centralized state from the 17th and 18th century onwards, where the notion of a state or an empire exists as a primary faction, or the notion of nationhood as opposed to statehood, where nationhood was determined by ethnicity and religion and many other matters, but the notion of a state is irrelevant. Okay. A tradition of religious and cultural tolerance characterized Iranian life from the time that Cyrus allowed the exiles to return to Zion through the end of Iranian rule nearly 1,000 years later in 640. Three Iranian dynasties, the Persian one deriving from the Achaemenids, the Parthian one deriving from the Arsacids, and another Persian one deriving from the Sassanids, affirmed the presence of diverse peoples and encouraged them to prosper. To be sure, when the Persian Sassanid dynasty overthrew the Parthian Arsacid one at the beginning of the 3rd century, there was a period of enthusiastic zealotry. But the political and social realities of a polyglot empire required a policy of toleration, and the government held each group responsible for its own doing. Only when a group appeared actively disloyal, as the Christians did after the Western enemy Rome turned Christian in the 4th century, did the Iranian government undertake systematic repression. Readers would do well to draw an analogy in thinking about the situation of the Jews in Babylonia from the political circumstances of the Julian America. That's a bit of a stretch. The reason is that the Jews of Babylonia, while a distinct and separate community, did participate in a cosmopolitan and diverse politics and society. The evidence is that the Jews in Babylonia lived in relatively close contact, both physical and cultural, with their neighbors. Their main center, Nahardia, was not far from the great Hellenistic city, Seleucia, on the Tigris. Greeks, Babylonians, pagan Semites, Jews, and Iranians inhabited the narrow strip of fertile land around the Royal Canal, which later historians so generously assigned to the Jews alone. It should be emphasized, therefore, the Jews were only one minority in the region, and they were not the most numerous. Furthermore, the Greek city of Seleucia contained a Hellenized Jewish population. Not only were Babylonian Jews in the Iranian times, both the Parthian and the Sassanid periods, not physically isolated from the others in the region, but there is evidence that some Jews significantly participated in Iranian political and economic life. For example, in the 1st century BC, Zamaris, a Jew from Babylonia who had mastered the Parthian shot, fled to the west and settled in Palestine. According to Josephus' account, Zamaris was a feudal lord in Parthia and fled on account of an unhappy turn in local politics. He was, moreover, not the only Jew to master Parthian military tactics. A century and a half later, we have some evidence that Jews took Parthian names, one Arta Ada being a good Parthian translation of the Hebrew Sadok, the other Kilibaris meaning possibly elephant rider. They wore Parthian noble garb and exerted influence with the government and were probably, therefore, also familiar with the language of the court. Moreover, we know that at least one Tana from Babylonia, Kia, visited the Iranian government, and that Parthian governmental title, Tahti, meaning satrap, was applied by him to his nephew Rab. We may, moreover, be fairly certain that good normative Jews, in particular Kia, participated in the international silk trade, which was closely supervised by the Parthian government, and hence must have had commercial dealings with that government. We know that a Jewish civil authority, the exilarch, was recognized by the Parthian government and exerted juror-controlled authority over Jews in the 2nd century, if not before. We know that he was given an insignia office, the right to wear the kamara, we learned about that earlier this evening, a belt which signified government recognition. The later Sasanian regime, about which we read in this book, clearly recognized the Jews as a political entity and conferred de jure authority of government on the exilarch. Thus, the evidence, very briefly summarized here, points to an extensive Jewish participation in Iranian affairs. Participation in political, commercial, and possibly military affairs could not have been carried out as people wholly isolated from the culture of the government. One should expect to find among them substantial marks of knowledge of surrounding culture. Not the least of the contacts of Jewish masters with that culture would have been through the coinage, which certainly yielded some information on the pagan religion of the Iranian Empire and the local Semitic and Philistic cults as well. In the period at hand, as much as our own day, one cannot distinguish religion from politics. An appreciation of the exilarch requires us to see the Jews' government in its religious settings as well. No era in the history of religion was more diverse or creative than late antiquity in Iranian, including, of course, Babylonia and Mesopotamia. No place ever exhibited greater variety of vitality than Mesopotamia. When we consider the milestone of religious activity in this brief period, we may see extraordinary signs of creativity and vitality. That is why the analogy to contemporary America proves apt, if not entirely exact, of course. In a small region, a parallelogram of no more than 200 miles in length and 50 in breadth, we find the following. First and most important, the resurgence of a conquering, proselytizing Mazdaism, propagated by the state under Ardashir and established, if in a parliament matter, as the state religion under Shapur with its exponent Kartir. Second, the development of an Iranian Gnostic syncretism by the prophet Mani, who at the time of the redecoration of the Dura synagogue proclaimed a new religion called Manichaeism, and in the next decades attracted a wide following in Iran and in the Roman Empire as well. Third, the advent of Christianity. Mani's father was probably a Christian, and Jesus played a part in his theology into the Mesopotamian Valley from Edessa, where by 201 had become well established. Fourth, the great expansion of cults within the Iranian idiom. In particular, Mithraism in both Iran and the Roman Empire, to the point where Mithraism was perhaps the single most popular religion on the Roman side of the frontier. Fifth, the beginnings of a revolution in Babylonian Judaism, which transformed the earlier indigenous religion into a fair representation of the Palestinian Tanaim, which this much we may say, but obviously no more, and which must have been created a tremendous upheaval in Babylonian Jewry. These events, each of them of lasting importance in the religious life of Mesopotamia, took place within a relatively brief period, one may say from circa 220 to 250, in Babylonia, Manichaeism, Rabbinic Judaism, and Mazdaism, not to mention Christianity, were all taking form. And their effects would play themselves out for the next 400 years until the rise of Islam. In that context, we should not be surprised to find in the Jewish writings concerning Babylonian Jewry in late antiquity many references to a Jewish government. In this book, I survey those references, drawing them together, etc., etc. In my view, I'll just read a few lines from chapter 1 and it will stop. The exilarate, as we know it, was organized by the regime of Vologases around 70 CE to solve two important problems. First of all, he and his government had to take into account the anarchy prevailing in Babylonia after the dynastic struggles of the previous half century. Among other groups, the Jews required attention. They had established their own state under Anileus and Asineus, those were these two high written men, Josephus describes as a former elite government, between 20 and 35, and after its collapse had suffered from the depredations of the Greeks and the Babylonians. A numerous group, the Jews could clearly not be ignored, nor could a government be satisfactorily entrusted to a territorial regime, for just as their rule over Greeks and Babylonians had proved unacceptable, so the latter could not effectively govern them. At the same time, the Parthians could make good use of Jewish officials, who both at home and abroad might win the support of their brethren for the Arsacid government. It was necessary, therefore, for the government, for domestic political reasons, to establish the institution charged with the government of Jews, and the normal means within the highly feudalized structure of the Arsacid Empire was to appoint a feudatory power owing direct responsibility and loyalty to the throne, in this case ruling a minority group settled over a large region rather than a circumscribed territory. Second, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 CE posed a serious problem to the Parthian government. In former times, Babylonian Jewry, like that of other parts of the diaspora, was deeply loyal to the temple. Pilgrims went up to Jerusalem, and temple collections of a half shekel were gathered regularly at Nardia in the south and in Nisibis in the north, and forwarded in armed caravans to the temple. The temple authorities, for their part, sent letters to Babylonia, as did the Pharisaic party, to advise the Jews on matters of calendrical regulation and other religious matters. After the destruction, the authority of the temple was assumed by the remnants of the Pharisaic party at Yafna, where, with Roman approval, the powers formerly exercised by the temple administration became vested in Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and Rabban Gamliel II after him. The Parthians enjoyed the services of an excellent intelligence bureau and must have known that the Palestinian Jewish authority would no longer be exercised by quasi-independent officials, but would, quite naturally, be very closely supervised by the Romans, as was the case. If the Parthians were willing to allow limited and, on the whole, politically neutral authority to be exerted from Jerusalem over their subjects, they would never permit a Roman functionary to do the same. So according to Neusler, and this is more or less one of his ideas that has been achieved acceptance over the years, the official existence of the Resh Galuta was a result of the Roman destruction of the temple and the necessity of, on the part of the Parthians, to establish a clear single individual which could act as the head of state of the Jewish autonomy group within that. And that's as I, and this is sort of the starting point of the history of the Exarch in the Encyclopedia of the Times, as you see. All right, we have more or less a picture of what was going on, not a clear one, but a reasonable one. And now we will move next week in Yetzir Hashem up until the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries, where, as a result of the Muslim invasion, the situation changed once again. There was now a greatly centralized authority. As we will read from the Quran, the Jews are to have their own judicial administration. And the high point of all of this was achieved under Rabbi Gaon and under his father, Rabbi Shira Gaon, in the 10th century. And we will see some the amazing diversity of the Jewish economic activity during that time. I wish I had a huge amount of time, because there is a great, really one of the great works of our time is the series of books called The Mediterranean Society by Professor Goitein. And this is an absolutely magnificent, unbelievable achievement. He essentially sifted through the garbage in the Geniza, not looking at all the scholarly documents, but looking at the day-to-day documents, and on the basis of that was able to reconstruct in an amazing fashion the nature and structure of Jewish society in the Mediterranean in the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries. Since that's not the subject of our course, I'll let you get a hold of Professor Goitein's book and read it yourself, but as one of the things we will learn from that is the wide range of power over the entire Jewish community someone like Rav Haigon had, something which probably never really existed prior to his time, nor subsequent to his time, and that we to be continued next week. A Mediterranean Society. It's six volumes. English. Yeah. It's in English.